Hello, Looking Up listeners. This is once again Josh Elstro, editor and audio producer for Looking Up. In the interest of keeping our staff safe and healthy and to help reduce the spread of COVID-19, I'm still the only member of the Looking Up team coming into the studio as we continue to quarantine until further notice. However, we still want to stay connected to our listeners as best we can. So we are revisiting some of our favorite guests and episodes in the Looking Up library until we can return to safely producing the podcast in studio. We think it's a great way for new listeners to get into the show. Whether revisiting or hearing it for the first time, we hope you enjoy Dean and Anna's June 2019 conversation with three-time shuttle astronaut and former director of flight operations for NASA, Dr. Janet Cavandi. So until we are able to return with brand new content, stay healthy, stay safe, and as Dean would say, keep looking up.
Hey, Anna, you know, back in the 20th century, we had this big space race between the United States and Russia.
Right.
And so now that the Cold War is over, now there's all these other players in the race for space. Mm. So we've got
I thought we won the race for space.
Well, I don't know.
Depends
on what the ultimate prize was. Oh. I mean, we were the first to the moon. We were not the first in space, but we seem to be the leader. But there's so many other countries now involved. So we've got the United States. We've got Russia. We've got the European Space Agency. We've got India. We've got China. And even Japan sending up spacecraft.
It's getting crowded up there.
So this is exciting for the future. It's not just like one place or one country that's racing against the other. It's like the whole world. And you could have these ideas where even individuals can send up satellites into space and CubeSats and things the size of like a Rubik's Cube send it up in space.
Oh, yeah. Why would you do whatever? Yeah, cool. Sorry. I mean, however people spend their time is their business.
Why in the world would you ever do that?
What would you do that for?
Well, apparently, so you can put a camera on one of these rocket things and take a picture of the curved Earth from space. So these individuals are like making little rockets and shooting them up at such high altitudes with cameras. And haven't you seen the pictures like little Smurfs? They're taking pictures, little troll dolls, and
what
little
keychains.
What are you
even talking about right now?
I guess I'm looking at different
websites.
I was going
to say, what are you doing in your free time? This is good. I worry.
I guess I look at spaceweather.com too long.
What is space weather? Whatever, it doesn't matter.
Check it out, everybody.
Okay, everyone look. We'll put a link on the Facebook.
Seems like every week somebody's launching something.
Are you serious?
Space. Yeah. We were going to do it too at the observatory, but then we couldn't get the clearance from all the airports. So, because then the stuff's going to fall down somewhere.
Oh, That's true, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe we're not thinking this through too well. Anyway, from the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
And I'm Anna Heeman, and we're both from the Cincinnati Observatory. Dean's the astronomer, and I've got questions that need answers. On this episode, we're joined by Dr. Janet Cavandi, NASA astronaut, recently inducted into the Astronaut Hall of Fame, and director of NASA's John H. Glenn Research Center in Cleveland. I want to say real quick, I'm excited we're talking to Dr. Cavandi. I have to say, I think it's funny that there is an Astronaut Hall of Fame. Isn't being an astronaut, I was saying this to our producer and our engineer, like, isn't that kind of that's the Hall of Fame there? There's an upper echelon of astronaut?
I don't know.
I just want to say that real quick.
If you went up once, isn't that good enough?
That's what they're like. Well, she went up three times because she's amazing.
That's pretty good.
So she's like... She owns the Hall of Fame.
There's not very many people have been up that high. And it's an elite company to make it even more elite. Then you have do you have diamond gold medallion status too?
It's not an airline. Oh, I got what you're saying. Dean, that was funny.
Oh, thanks,
Dean made a joke, you guys. It was really good.
Well, anyway, back on topic.
Anyway, sorry. I just wanted to say.
No, that's right.
Astronauts. It's like, oh, sorry, you're not in the Hall of Fame, but you could be an astronaut. Okay.
Are they going to have a wax figure of her there? Like, you can press a button and she'll say, Story Musgrave says this.
Scott
Kelly says.
That's right. Yeah. I like that you're like listing off the astronauts. That's good. You're like, I know who astronauts are. So it's a big anniversary of the moon landing.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge.
Very big.
Very big. Very exciting.
Yes.
Coming up at us this summer. And I think that, you know, your point about now everybody's in space, everybody's doing their thing. I mean, it was a big deal, though, 50 years ago, because it was just, was it just two countries? It was pretty just us and Russia,
two
right?
Two countries, right, yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, us and the Soviet Union. We were racing towards the moon and who could get there first or who could get into space first.
Because they did that first, right?
That's right, yeah. So Yuri Gagarin was the first person up in space, and mm-hmm. he orbited the Earth. And then, I mean, the undertones of this was who controls space might control the whole planet. And if you have this capability of sending things up in orbit, then mm-hmm. you can also send missiles and other unfortunate things down on other countries. And so this became
I thought it was kind of a friendly rivalry. That just...
This was not a friendly rivalry at all. That's the thing, because there was this tension about this as to who is going to control outer space. And so it wasn't all nice and shiny like it is today,
mm-hmm.
Because now we go up to the space station. We use Russian rockets to go up there. We have a lot of international people there. It's like this.
It's collaborative.
It is. It's very collaborative. Nice. But back then it really was a race. And the first human was Yuri Gagarin to circle the Earth and to go up into space. And then mm-hmm. Before that, it was the first animal was a Russian
Laika.
Animal, Laika, the first dog that was in space.
I think that's such a cute name.
And then the United States got into it a little bit later. They were behind a few years, and they sent up monkeys first, and then
what are their names?
Abel and Baker, I think, were the first two.
Didn't make it.
No, they.
I don't know.
Let's just
pretend like they went to live on a farm somewhere, and everything's fine.
They're still here.
Those crazy
they're
monkeys.
They're backstage.
We're gonna bring them out. Interview them here in a minute.
That's right. But then, the first American was Alan Shepard that went up into space. And then there's other missions that followed.
So we were behind.
We were behind in the beginning, that's for sure.
Even though America's number one, obviously.
And there were so many tests that failed. That's the thing is that if you look at the early missions, the early test launches, there were so many rockets that exploded on the ground, that exploded up in the air.
Oh my gosh.
And this was not looking good for us. Like, we just couldn't, like, figure out what was the problems with these. But and that's why being an astronaut is so dangerous. You're basically... on the top of this firework, basically, this giant,
but like a firework on like steroids,
right? Yeah, and that's the thing is, can you control it to send this up in space? And so, we finally got it figured out pretty well, and so the missions we caught up very quickly after that because the Russians would send spacecrafts out, and they did manned missions. They also did the first spacewalk. And then mm-hmm. they also sent the first spacecraft to the moon, too. This was unmanned spacecrafts that some landed on the moon and one that circled around the backside of the moon and came back.
Oh, yeah.
And it had passengers. The Soviet mission went around the backside of the moon with...
That's like showing off.
It was.
Like, would you want to hear about the backside of the moon? Because we've been there.
That's right.
Trash talk.
Because, the moon that we see, we can only see one half of the moon from Earth. That other side
half.
Is always the near side, forefront half, either one, near side. And then there's the far side.
Semantics.
What would you call the far side?
The back half.
Back half. Very good, very good.
I'm going to call it the far side, though.
Okay, let's go with that. So, the far side of the moon, the first images were from the Soviet spacecrafts.
Uh-huh.
So that means they got to name all that stuff. So a lot of the big features on the far side of the moon have Russian names to them.
But that's like the back. Who cares? They can have the back. We're in the front.
Yeah, that's
right. We got this. Thanks, Russia.
Yeah. Well, the front, we didn't get the front either. Somebody figured that out earlier. But anyway.
Dean, America's the best.
That's right. So so they were ahead of us pretty far, but what we caught up with was that we were able to do rendezvous in space. So we mm-hmm. could like send up a spacecraft, link up with another spacecraft up in orbit, and that was one of the things that that we did with some of the second missions, the Gemini missions that came uh-huh. after the Mercury missions. And so that's one of the ones that Neil Armstrong kind of got his experience with, was these missions to send up rockets up there and then connect with other spacecrafts.
But
whose
spacecrafts? Ours?
Ours and some Soviet. We did a joint program in the Cold War where they linked up in space, opened up the hatch, shook hands across the thing.
I mean,
it was
nice.
And that's what, that was.
Is that what it's called, Gemini? Twins.
Gemini is because there's two people on those.
Twins.
Yeah, but they're two Americans, and then there's.
Oh, I thought it was like Gemini, meaning like two Russia or USSR and America. Okay.
Yeah. Well, the first series of Americans ones were called the Mercury ones, and that was just one passenger.
Okay.
And then the second series of the Gemini, and that was two passengers.
Yeah.
But then they linked up with Russia, and there was like three or four.
Oh, then it anyway. Like got two.
No,
okay.
we didn't count the Soviets in that one.
Of course not.
And then the third series of missions were the Apollo missions, where they had to do. I mean, just the amount of work to get to the moon was crazy. So they launch off of the Earth. Then they circle around the Earth 1.5 times. Then they accelerate all the way to the moon.
Okay.
They also have to take the lander from the one side of the spacecraft, go out, flip it around, put it on the front side of the spacecraft.
What?
Then go to the moon, then circle around the moon, then drop half the spacecraft down onto the moon while the other one's circling the moon, then jump back up, rendezvous with the circling for the one, and then head back to Earth.
This is exhausting.
It was exhausting. It's an 8-day journey there and back. And so was exhausting. This is the feat that has not been replicated. The last mission to the moon was 1972, and we have not gone back with that kind of a mission that could do that kind of anything we've sent to the moon now has been one-way trips and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Because, you know, it does beg the question, we went 50 years ago, should we, like, be living there now? just kidding.
Well, no. I mean, this is what people were thinking. We should. And, in fact, a lot of people, if you would have told people in 1970, oh, yeah, it's 2019, nobody's on the moon, they would have thought you probably were crazy.
They're
like, well, if we went to the moon, what's the big deal?
Yeah, certainly, we own it now.
Certainly future people can go to the moon easily, but it's such a difficult task to do. And that's what makes the Apollo 11 mission so unbelievable, just the engineering that went into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the only thing that we can think of now is let's go to Mars. How about let's go a little farther?
That's all you can think about.
I know. I love it.
I know.
I love.
Unless you admit it, you're like, yeah, pretty much.
I would love to see somebody else do it. I'm not just so exclusive. They're not asking for me to do it anyway.
Oh, well, I mean, you never know. You get a phone call any minute. You're a NASA solar. What is it? What is the ambassador?
I'm a NASA solar system ambassador.
Solar system ambassador.
But I also have 2,500.
We're going to send our top brass.
I do have 2,500 vision, so I don't think they would want. My glasses break.
Oh my gosh.
You don't want a blind person on Mars.
We'll just LASIK that right up.
Oh.
Get you up there, buddy.
All right. We'll make it a package. LASIK plus trip to Mars. How can I refuse that? I'm not sure how many people realize that NASA operates a 3,200-person research center in Cleveland, Ohio, or that it's directed by a 3-time shuttle astronaut who once served as the director of flight crew operations for NASA. And she was also recently inducted into the U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame. We are truly honored to welcome Dr. Janet Cavandi to Looking Up. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, you have a kind of a long and storied history with NASA. We were wondering what got you into NASA and becoming an astronaut?
It was something that I was always interested in, even as a child. I was always fascinated by the night sky. I lived in the Midwest. I could see all the stars at night. I know you're an astronomer and probably have the same love, but just probably looking up at the night sky and seeing the natural universe spread out there, but also the stars that seem to move, you know, which were, you know, not the stationary objects, but the ones that perhaps people were in and circling the Earth, and the concept that we could actually travel up there and be, you know, not truly amongst the stars, but it looked like it was when I was a kid, and thinking how I could make that a career path.
Wow, that's a great sort of lead into the next question, which how can you tell us a little bit about your emotions and feelings and experience the first time you went up in space?
Sure, because, you know, that is an amazing opportunity, and so few people are afforded the opportunity that I am just so very grateful for it. I first of all, just to work to get to that point was a lot of school and anticipation and so when you're finally sitting in that seat and you're hearing the countdown to the zero mark, and you're hoping to feel the engines light and that, you know, you won't be you know, canceled at the last minute. When you do feel the engines and hear everything starting to happen, it's just an exhilarating moment that, you know, all those years of school and all that effort and trying to apply and being interviewed and selected, it all comes to fruition in that moment. And so that was just a really exciting time to feel, you know, pushed off the pad and the exhilaration of the launch and the roll so you could actually see the earth as you rolled upside down. And then, of course, when the engines cut off, you float out of your seat and actually go to the window and see the earth from space, which is, you know, the opposite position that I was at when I was that little kid down on the planet looking up and wondering what it would be like.
And so you've been in space three times?
Correct.
Is that correct? And what kind of projects do you do? Like, what's your kind of like day-to-day life up in space, up in orbit?
Yeah, so depending on when you go and which vehicle you flew, I happen to fly all of my missions on the space shuttle. So they are relatively short in duration compared to being a long-term International Space Station astronaut. But on the space shuttle, on my first mission, I went to the Russian space station Mir. We were part of a joint program with the Russians at that time on allowing Americans to spend longer periods of time in space than we typically did by staying long periods of time on the Mir space station. And we also took, you know, different kinds of experiments up on board the space stations. We still do that today with the International Space Station, which is where I went on my last flight. I helped construct the International Space Station and added the airlock to the space station, which is the module where we can go out and do spacewalks. We can depress it and go outside and do a spacewalk, come back in. My middle mission was mapping the Earth in high definition, three dimensions. And that is a product that most people probably use on their iPhones and don't even realize that they're using data from spaceflight to show maps of the Earth and their map, you know, application. So those are three things that I contributed to. But on the International Space Station today, where people stay 6 months at a time, their full-time job is pretty much doing experiments, all kinds, from material science to life science kinds of experiments to weather to, you know, Earth observations, all kinds of experiments that you can do in the microgravity environment and from that particular vantage point up there above the Earth.
So you went up three times. That's amazing. I'm sure you had many incredible experiences. Is there, and it sounds like you worked on some really kind of amazing projects. Is there any one sort of memorable experience that you'd like to share? We were just, you know, curious about some of the interesting stories from your travels.
Oh gosh, there's so many, you know. There's views that I remember that are just magnificent. It's something that you don't get to see from here. I mentioned from the vantage point of that particular position up there going around the Earth every 90 minutes. You know, it's 45 minutes day and 45 minutes night. And so on a night pass, I remember in particular flying from the north side of Europe. So starting sort of in the coming over the British Isles and seeing London, and then you come across Europe and you can see Paris and you can see Rome, and Italy really is very well defined at night because it's the boot and it's all lit up in the dark Mediterranean. So you can see the outline of Italy very clearly. Then we came across to Egypt and you could see Cairo and you could see the Nile Delta all lit up. And then we passed over Africa, and then it got very dark because there are not as many city lights over the central portion of the continent of Africa. But you could see things like campfires at night, and people are down there. But it's just a different culture and advancement of technology at that point in time in that particular location. And yeah, it was just a really fascinating trip to know that you passed over so much of the world population and you saw so much of it in maybe 15 minutes. It was just, you know, like you just wish that everyone else had the opportunity to look at the Earth from that vantage point.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, I mean, just the perspective that you gain from that, I could see that should be something that so many people could benefit from. And how do you you bring that back to your earthly job here at the NASA Glenn Center? Tell us about that. What do you guys do at NASA Glenn up in Cleveland?
Right. So there are essentially 10 NASA centers around the country, each of them with their own specialties. We are a research center, which means in code that we do a lot of aeronautics research. So most people are very familiar with the space side of NASA. That's the S in NASA, but the first A in NASA is aeronautics. So we do work in wind tunnels on everything from commercial airline type design and engine development and anti-icing to supersonic work for the Department of Defense and even into the hypersonic range. So that's kind of what we do for the aeronautics side. On the space side, we have some pretty amazing test facilities, some of the largest in the world. That we have two campuses, and on our campus out in Sandusky, Ohio, we have the Sunbrook Station, which has the world's largest vacuum chamber and acoustics chamber and vibration capability, so that we can really put full-scale spaceflight hardware through the ringer there before we actually launch it, to make sure that if it's going to break, if anything's going to fall off or not work properly, it will do it in that location so that we can fix it and make sure we make it more rugged, so that when we launch it for real, that we won't have any failures. So
the biggest vacuum chamber.
That's interesting.
How big is this vacuum chamber?
Vacuum chamber is 100 feet in diameter and about 5 stories tall. So it is the world's largest.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, it's huge.
Five stories tall.
And so we can put full scale upper stage of rockets in there, and we do not only NASA rockets but other commercial rockets in that location, and we're able to test them there. So it's a really fascinating capability and facility that is really unmatched anywhere else in the world.
That is incredible.
And the reason for that testing, just you know, for awareness, because space, of course, above the atmosphere, we are essentially at vacuum or very close to it up there. So as we all know, when we fly, your ears, you know, pop, and, you know, the gases, you know, expand as we go higher. Well, at pure vacuum, humans cannot survive in pure vacuum, but hardware has to. So we test electronic equipment in the hot-cold cycles. So being in front of the sun, you know, at full exposure to the sun, equipment gets very hot. And then on the other side of the Earth, where they're shaded from the sun, things get very cold, so their temperature extremes are great. So that combined with the vacuum makes for a pretty hostile environment for equipment to work in reliably. So we're able to simulate that in this large vacuum chamber and make sure that it will work before we actually ship it to space.
Well, last night we had a group at the observatory, and we saw the space station and the Chinese space station go overhead, and it just was so amazing. The group of kids that were there were just so fascinated by it, and, you know, just saying there's actually people up there. And I think just having that human presence in space really does inspire people. And so we're so thankful for your time here today and giving us that perspective of what the Earth looks like from space.
Definitely.
Pleasure.
We've been talking with Dr. Janet Cavandi, director of NASA's John H. Glenn Research Center in Cleveland, Ohio, and a recent inductee into the U.S. Astronauts Hall of Fame. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Cavandi.
Well, in doing our programs and working with so many kids, we get a lot of fun kid questions. They ask the darndest things, as they say. So we received one recently that's very convenient for this conversation, this episode, and it's about, basically the question is, what's life, what would life be like on the moon?
Yeah, I mean, this is something to really, that people have been dreaming about.
Because we're going to be living there soon.
You see that moon up there every night, and you think, oh, you know, what is it like up there? And it is very different from here on Earth. So, number one,
it looks the same.
It looks well. Okay, so it's rocky. That's true. You could stand on it.
Yeah.
But it is not a friendly, it's not a human-friendly place. Yeah. It
looks so calm and peaceful.
I know. Well, that part is probably right. Oh. But, I mean, there's no, like, wind or weather or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you pretty much know what you're in for. So daytime temperatures are going to be about 200 degrees Fahrenheit. Nighttime temperatures are going to be about 180 below or so.
I like to sleep cold, but that's a little too cold.
Yeah. Well,
if then, can I bring my heater?
Yeah.
Can I bring my space heater?
Bring your space heater. Perfect.
Okay, sorry. I don't want to get derailed.
Oh, my goodness.
I just wanted to make a joke.
And so the other parts about day and night that you might not like so much is a day is not a day. A day on the moon lasts about 15 Earth days. So you would have the sun up for 15
straight days. I could finish my to-do list, though. Probably.
That's true. And then the night times also last about 14 or 15 days.
Seriously?
So you go 14 days without seeing the sun, basically.
Well, in the day, though, I would see the sun, and
right.
It looks like daytime.
Sun would be up for 14 straight days. And then
at 200 degrees Fahrenheit. I might need sunblock.
Could be, yes. Don't
I'm not
work in the yard.
Live there.
Yeah, and so then nighttime would be 200 below, and you have that for 14 days in a row. Now, so all the astronauts all went up there during daytime because they want to see stuff. And so we've never had anybody be on the moon at night.
Because why would you?
We've had unmanned spacecrafts and landers there that have survived through the long night. But it would be very difficult for humans to get adjusted to that kind of thing. Then you've got the radiation exposure that you have. If there's solar flares that are happening, you're not protected like you are here on Earth. And so any kind of settlement we'd have, you got to like guard against heat, cold, radiation.
And never go outside.
And not go out very often, unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, it could be very claustrophobic being an astronaut. So I know I'm not selling this very well, but...
Not to me. No.
But the plus side, you got the lower gravity.
No.
So you weigh 1/6 on the moon, what you weigh here
down
on
with
Earth.
That.
So that's a plus.
Okay.
Lots of open space. You like that?
Open space. Space to roast or freeze it?
I love it.
Yeah, spacious yards you to just die in.
There's nothing else out there. So you can, you want that crater? That's your crater.
That's your crater.
You can hang out in that crater.
You fill it with whatever you want.
You can tell one crater from the other. That's yours.
We
always talk about Neil Armstrong's words, when he landed on the moon. But when I think of the moon, I also think of Buzz Aldrin's phrase. He called it magnificent desolation. That's because all
it's
it
beautiful.
Is gray rocks and more gray rocks. It's
until you get like a Starbucks up there, and then all of a sudden things start popping.
It could start happening.
It's just unsettled.
Well, I mean, that street corner needs some work. We need some kind of business to take over there. But
crater.
It is a very unreal thing. But another plus is you get to see the Earth from the moon.
Yeah,
so
that'd
the
be pretty.
Earth will hang there. It's almost stationary, actually, up there in the sky because you're facing the Earth all the time if you're on the near side.
The good side, the near side,
the American side.
Yeah.
The Russian side's always facing the other way. And so, if you're on the near side, then you always see the Earth up there. And so you can always at least see where you live. But it
see
would
where
be
you
a,
left.
It would be a quite a drastic, and I don't know what kind of psychological thing is to see this blue-green glowing orb up there where your home is. And then you look around at magnificent desolation.
And your giant crater, you're just like,
exactly.
You're just starfishing in there. Just like, in my crater, nobody come find me. I'm good.
It is not a life of luxury being an astronaut, that's for sure. But the adventure and the idea of going where nobody's gone before.
It's amazing.
That could appeal to a lot of people.
That's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks to Dr. Janet Cavandi for joining us. You'll find a link to her and the Glenn Research Center on our website, wvxu.org/lookingup.
We're about to celebrate our second anniversary. Woo!
What?
I can't believe it.
Oh my gosh, they're keeping us.
Ah. So if you've been listening from the start or are new to Looking Up, we'd sure love to hear from you with a topic or guest ideas, space questions, or whatever's on your mind. Drop us an email at lookingup@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter.
Parents, we hope you'll share Looking Up with your kids and send us any questions they may have. And if you're a teacher, we'd love to hear from you and your students about space, planets, astronauts, whatever. Our email is lookingup@wvxu.org.
You can subscribe to Looking Up wherever you listen to podcasts. And please give us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts. If you're new to Looking Up, you can always find all of our past episodes at wvxu.org/lookingup.
Our theme song and additional music is by Why, that's W-H-Y question mark, from their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstrow is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.